There are a lot of ways to make a movie that's gripping. And one of the ways that has always fascinated me the most is at the heart of the film I'm talking about with my guest today, John Madden. I'm George Edelman, editor-in-chief at No Film School and host of the No Film School podcast. And John Madden is a very accomplished director. You're certainly familiar with his work, whether it's Shakespeare in Love, Best Exotic Marigold, among many others dating back to the 80s on television. Even did something that had quite an impact on me that I didn't realize until we started talking, really, was the Star Wars radio dramas from the 80s that NPR did. He directed all of them. So his background in theater, radio, et cetera, he'll tell you about how all of that led him to cinema and his insane success there. But back to this movie, Operation Mincemeat, which comes out on Netflix and in select theaters. And the film is available on Netflix now, so you can go watch it. But one of the things we really get into, besides for how John built his career, is how this story works around the kind of tension that it creates. Just for a little background, Operation Mincemeat was a real thing that happened in World War II. It's a fascinatingly strange thing. It's something that people have obsessed over and spun yarns about or kind of riffed on since then, including a number of movies you've probably seen, including a movie about it based on a book that one of the men involved in it wrote. But the key is you don't want to know too much going in, and you don't need to know too much going into this interview, just that it was a plan, a sort of a Trojan horse style ruse put on by the British in 1943 during World War II. And the rest of it, I think you just have to let happen, but you'll find out more as you listen to the interview and hopefully afterwards watch the film. But you can definitely listen to this before because we're not spoiling anything. And I hope that in listening to it before, it makes you more aware of some of the things that people can do in a very limited setting. You don't need a lot of set pieces or a lot of bells and whistles to create something that really grabs audiences. So here we go. Thank you so much for being here. It's exciting to talk about this project. It's, of course, very exciting to have you. You've had a long and incredible career as a director. So I guess I like to start with this. What sort of began your first steps or entree into the film industry as a film director? What was the beginning for you with that? What started the path for you?
I came at film directing. Sort of had to understand a little bit about how the climate worked in the UK. But the simple answer is that I actually came into it initially via theatre. You know, that I was involved in theatre at university. I ran a Shakespeare company after university and, you know, which stood me in good stead later. Initially, I came to America, strangely enough, to work on a radio drama project. And I found out from there and became a theater director in the US and then went back to the UK and worked in British television really as a director. I mean, I was actually splitting between the two. I was doing theater over here and getting my feet wet in terms of making films for British television, which really functioned as the independent film industry at that time. Most of the kind of key directors were working in that space because
and that was just because I'm pretty familiar. I've been looking at and familiar with your resume. So was the radio you came out here to do was the Star Wars radio drama?
No. I was actually I was working the BBC in radio drama, and they were looking for some kind of guidance, I suppose, in America to set up a radio drama outfit, which actually was called Earplay. It was a radio drama project that was funded out of the University of Wisconsin by a former radio actor who was a professor of communications at the University of Wisconsin. And they got money from PBS to set up a, you know, to see if we could revive radio drama as a serious medium in the US, because obviously when radio went commercial largely, it became wall-to-wall music essentially. and, you know, the glory days of Orson Welles and so forth sort of disappeared. And there was some sort of, you know, genre elements, but no serious attempt to kind of take advantage of serious writing in a radio sense. So I came over to work on that project.
And it worked to some extent to revive some of it because...
It absolutely did. No. We had some pretty serious writers working for us. So David Mamet, Edward Albee, Arthur Kopit, who wrote a play that I directed for Earplay that then went on to have a stage life and actually a television life as well, called Wings. So Sam Shepard, I mean, there were a lot of people who actually wrote for that project because it turns out, you know, not surprisingly, dramatists like it because it's not in the way, it's just words.
Not so visual, yeah.
The reason that Star Wars came about is because George Lucas had bequeathed the radio drama rights to USC in perpetuity. And then the idea actually came up, and I'm not going to remember the name of the key players here for a second.
NPR?
It was NPR, but they basically said, well, who do we go to kind of deal with this? And the only people who were actually practicing radio drama at that sort of level was us. This outfit called Earplay. So they approached us, and a guy called Tom Vagley, who was my kind of collaborator, was a brilliant engineer. And we took that on and as you know, did not all at once, but all three films, versions of all three films with a guy called Brian Daly, who wrote the scripts for that.
And they were really expanded versions of the stories and included a lot of the cast and tons of special effects in the music and were quite a production. And you were a pretty young director in the context as well, right?
It was quite a production. Yeah, we had access to the original score and Ben Burtt's sound library. And it was all through Lucasfilm. So it had their blessing. And Brian Daly, who did the dramatizations with us, was, you know, had a gig with Lucasfilm writing the novelizations of the scripts, of the original film scripts as well.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I feel like that, and then going back and doing television that included Sherlock Holmes and stuff, you were stepping into some very, very big projects very early. But I'm curious, you know, your development as a director going from theater to something like radio, where you lose all the visual elements, how you felt like that sort of, and working with some of those greatest writers too.
Yeah, it's true, but there's more of an overlap, you know, with radio and film actually than you would necessarily expect, because I think, for example, the rhythm of the way a story unfolds is something that's absolutely crucial to an effective radio drama. And, you know, obviously film is a visual medium, but in terms of the grammar of production, in terms of how you tell a story, how you manage a story, it's extraordinary how crucial sound and rhythm and the relationship between silence and noise and so forth are very, very central. And I find that actually even now when I'm working on a script, I tend to go through a kind of a sort of sound envelope fairly early on in terms of how the story actually works rhythmically, because rhythm is the key to everything, I think, in cinematic storytelling. So I suppose that was always there in the background for me. But I started to, I mean, particularly growing up in the time that I was growing up, already or coming into the business, there was a huge sort of explosion of creativity, particularly in American cinema. And of course, there was a sort of counterbalancing kind of golden age in European cinema as well, which both influenced the British film scene. And, you know, I was working in a world where the writer had a kind of primacy in British television. That was true. You know, projects were very often evaluated on the strength of a script by some pretty serious writers. And so you had a kind of all of those elements coming together in one place. And that was really the kind of the launch pad for my generation or the generation just ahead of me, but of people. So, you know, Anthony Minghella and Danny Boyle and Roger Michel and myself and all of those people, and the one just ahead of us, Stephen Frears, Mike Newell and Michael Apted and all those people, all came out of the television channel. I mean, we all came from the same place as that, you know, the kind of cinematic aspects of what was going on started to expand. Because you've got to remember, at that time in British television, almost all drama was on video.
Yeah.
It was multi-camera video shot in a studio with the exterior elements being what we used to call film inserts. when in an Austin adaptation, they'd step out of the studio and mount a horse, which was shot on 16mm film, until gradually, you know, some of the sort of heavyweight practitioners or the people who were, you know, at the top of their game, like Ken Loach and Stephen Frears and so forth, got to make full length versions of stories that were shot on 16mm film. And in my case, that's true, you know, that my first, well, actually, I made a couple of feature films in America, but the one that kind of put me on a particular trajectory was Mrs. Brown, which was originally made on 16mm film for the BBC as a what was called a Screen 1. They had two different strands, Screen 1 and Screen 2, which just meant one was destined for a bigger audience on BBC One, and the other was on a slightly smaller audience, a slightly more niche material on something called Screen 2. So that was a Screen 1, and then that film was sort of snapped up, I suppose. There was just a point where they were beginning to consider whether there might be some possibility of limited release of those films in a theatrical context. And a couple, one that Stephen Frears had done called The Snapper, came up through that route. And and Harvey Weinstein at Miramax picked up Mrs. Brown.
Yeah, I think there's so many things I want to ask or dig into, and I definitely want to get into Operation Mincemeat specifically soon. Yeah. But just talking a little bit about background and specifically learning or cutting your teeth, so to speak, with various mediums or limitations.
Yeah.
And learning that, you know, to put story first, script first, sound first, before you had the power of shooting all kinds of things. Because today, we have kind of this backwards ability, which is great in certain ways, but the tools to get almost any visual are readily available, right?
Well, that's absolutely true. It's absolutely true, yes. You could describe you as going backwards. You could say that's going forwards, really. But no, it's absolutely true. In our day, there was no way of having access to the materials you needed to make a film or to tell a story in film terms unless you went through just the beginning of a burgeoning renaissance in British film, independent British film, low budget, or through the television route. And so I suppose it's where your skill set comes from. It tends to be, I think, this is a ridiculous generalization because different people develop in different ways, but the primacy of character and of writing was held very, very highly in the world that I grew up in. Developed in, you know, when I started to work in this field as a living. And so those elements were ones that you were always looking for first to find or to develop in a project, not without there being a cinematic circumstance. Whereas over here, for example, the effect of this sort of extraordinary landscape that comprises the US, both urban landscape as well as natural landscape, just gave you a different sort of portal into the storytelling. Yeah, and it was the sort of cross-fertilization of those things that actually made it exciting, really, because as the British film industry started to develop and take off, it became more significant over here in terms of its reach because of, you know, the mini majors and the development of that whole idea of small films that started with a very small budget, but but managed to find much, much larger audiences.
We still have a dedicated large audience here, and obviously there's one internationally, though, for specifically the style of Smaller Thing that's yes. coming from that same exact kind of, I don't know what to call it, but that sort of original circle or pool mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. style. And so there's an appetite for it because of its contrast and because yes. of its difference. And because there's people always talk about story and character first, mm-hmm. but they aren't necessarily doing it because they don't have to. Something about being forced to makes it a true priority, I think.
Yes. Yes, I think that's probably right.
So bringing us up to, you know, obviously relationship with Miramax, with basically becoming these kinds of, you know, making many films, many of which are like major award-winning films, and the industry has changed a ton. We could talk yeah. about all the ways it's changed, but we're here, and it's Operation Mincemeat, which is an old story, a true story and a crazy one. It has roots in actual history. In cinema, of course, because it's been told, but also because of James Bond, it's got another weird route. So can you tell me how you came at this story with all of its, with the web of things that it touches on and how you kind of broke it down?
Well, so the key entity here actually is Ben McIntyre's book, which was the basis for the film, which was called Operation Mincemeat. That in and of itself was a retelling of a story of which there was an existing account, as you're aware, written by Ewan Montague, who's one of the two key planners of the operation, who sued in the sense of campaigned to be able to tell the story of that after the war ended, but got a lot of pushback from the intelligence community for certain reasons of certain sensitivities they didn't really want revealed and so forth. And so The Man Who Never Was, which is the title of that.
Oh, thing. I forgot to mention Hitchcock weaved into all of this, but that's right.
Well,
okay.
Yes.
Continue.
Yes, absolutely. And anyway, then that was made into a film, as you know, in 1956 called The Man Who Never Was, which was a spectacular work of fiction, of course, because partly understandable fiction, because you have to kind of shape the story to tell it cinematically, but most particularly because the thing that the intelligence services were very concerned about was the revelation as to whose body they used, which itself has become a kind of a conspiracy theory of sorts. And the reason Ben McIntyre undertook this, partly because it is his sphere of, you know, his speciality is actually, you know, espionage during the war years, and he's written a lot of books on that subject. But he had access to the files, because they were declassified in 1996, and suddenly the whole reality of what went on in that in an unexpurgated form, and particularly the identity of the body.
Isn't it fascinating that all that time there were all these versions that people were spinning out of the minimal amount of information we had?
Totally. That's what it's all about. You know what's interesting about the whole project is that it's all about speculation. Even the story itself is about that. It's about, after all, what is espionage? It's actually hunches and guesswork and speculation. And the one thing that is guaranteed is that there is no certainty about anything. It's only a bet that you're making that something will work, or that the construction you're putting on it is valid or true. And there's no better example of that than, as you say, people trying to figure out whose body was that. and even now, though it's absolutely known and properly validated that it was Glendower Michael, for example, whose name now appears on Bill Martin's grave in Huelva, there's still conspiracies going on around that.
I think people like the mystery.
They do. Of course they do. And, now conspiracy theories, of course, consume us in
a terrible way.
Possible sphere, in a terrible way. I mean, it's a blight, actually. It's a blight on modern experience. But very interesting. So it was Ben's book, which was really an exhaustive opening up of the whole thing. And it is the most extraordinary idea and the most bizarre idea. You can't really quite believe that they pursued it to its logical conclusion. It's one thing I would just say here that I, I would, in terms of talking about it, because people will now obviously be able to see it whenever they want on the Netflix platform, that I kind of speak about it guardedly because it's not a story whose outcome people know about.
Yes.
And actually, it makes it a much more interesting experience as a film when you are not told what the outcome is. And so...
I agree. I think that the less people know going in, the better. Yeah,
exactly that. So, you know, in terms of talking about it, that's one thing I would say. But it is true that, you know, it's a story that keeps you guessing, that actually you find, really, is that what they did? And is that how that worked? And so forth. And to me, apropos of the things that we were talking about earlier in this podcast, it pulls together a whole number of things that I was particularly interested in. So it's at some level, it's sort of procedural. Obviously, yeah. It's a procedural story, but only at one level. It's also about the business of writing, the business of storytelling. It has an emotional component that is quite, you know, braided into the story and certainly was in life. It's really, I suppose, if I were to characterize it simply, it's about people who get together to create a fiction and then become lost in the fiction that they've created. realize actually that they can't control the fiction that they've created either. And all of that rolls up into a sort of heightening sense of how huge the stakes are if this idea goes wrong.
It feels like something, there's so much to talk about, but it feels like something that is such a natural fit for people who spend their lives telling stories. Whenever filmmakers or creators get to tell one of these kinds of stories, they get to bring a lot of their own experience about crafting narrative because it's about the craft of narrative. And people forget, we think of spy more now, and espionage has morphed a little bit into action when its initial roots are more about that, what I think in the Hitchcock sense always was like an ironic tension where like, well, so-and-so knows X, but the other person only knows Y, but then they know X, but who knows both things? And then the audience knows all things. And then like, and it's a game that constantly advances a little bit.
And it also, that kind of storytelling is one that if you can get, you know, do your job right, then you engage the audience in that configuration that you're talking about, where they're trying to figure out whether A plus B equals C or equals Z. And I think that that's where things get very interesting in storytelling terms, rather than, you know, the perfectly valid and intensely gripping sense of action unfolding. Because this film is mainly, it's framed by, you know, the action world that we're familiar with from World War II movies, which is, you know, bombs and bullets and blood and conflict, you know, raw conflict of men.
The highest stakes imaginable.
The highest possible stakes. But actually, the story that we're telling is the one that's underground, many miles away, where theories and ideas are being spun and developed. And also, this is a parenthesis, but also in a world where you're not familiar with from World War II cinematic literature, which is, you know, the smoking ruins of London, you know, after the Battle of Britain, and or, you know, the shores of Normandy or the Dunkirk evacuation or whatever these things are. This is a 1943, no bombs have dropped on London that year. Life is carrying on. People have eked out a different kind of way of enjoying themselves and living a kind of a normal life while the war goes on somewhere else. And in our particular case, those people are living in that world, but dedicating themselves to this extravagant fiction that is sort of minutely worked out in this underground bunker, you know, which doesn't sound like a promising idea for a film. But of course, I think it is once you start to explode that and really take it apart.
Well, it's dramatic. It has potential to be, when you play with that level of drama, the other kind of film history that comes to mind for me is the Lubitsch To Be or Not to Be, where there's also World War II stakes. It's theatrical. And that one, it's used for comedic effect. But it's a similar idea of using ideas and knowledge as a weapon interplay with a dangerous enemy. And I think that, and it just like the Hitchcock versions, it veers on it veers on suspense and comedy because it's out of control.
Well, it's true. And actually, that's kind of critical. It's one of the great attractions of this from my point of view, because, you know, I like films of mixed tone because you can wrong foot an audience, or you can pull an audience into a tighter engagement with something, because if they're laughing, they're immediately engaged. And if that laugh suddenly reverses on itself when you realize why they're laughing, then that's kind of really interesting. Hitchcock was, of course, a master of that, wasn't afraid of, you know, the really bad joke, the banana skin that goes under the plot at the wrong moment. And
a great cast for it. I want to ask you about working with, you know, you've worked with a lot of the great actors of times, but like this is, you know, bringing in Colin Firth, Matthew McFadden, who's incredible, but also, as we know, hilarious if he needs to be. Kelly MacDonald. It's a lot of really talented people.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about working with actors and because that's certainly a strength you've had. And I don't know if you have specific advice or approaches or, you know, casting and things like that.
I mean, I think, look, for this kind of project, we have an extraordinary reservoir of talent in the UK. There are people who grow up with a sense of this era, particularly, already in their bones. I think, you know, one of the things that I'd have to pay enormous tribute to Michelle Ashford, who is American, who's written a, you know, idiomatically very, very intuitive and nuanced version of the way people spoke and thought.
Did you work with her at all to achieve that?
Yeah,
that must have been quite a challenge to take something.
She was already on sound footing, but there were obviously occasions where we were training versions of the script a lot of the time, only because I was giving her feedback on that, or that's a weird expression from our point of view, or whatever it may be. But I think that's a partial answer to the question you just asked me, which is that if you've got a script that immediately comes off the page in a certain kind of a way, you're not, in an ideal world, going to have trouble attracting the actors you want, assuming they're available. And also about the subject matter. So I think that people did respond to this, you know, strongly. And most of the people that I went to, you know, who were available, there weren't, I can't remember people saying no to it particularly, but they might have done for one reason or another. But, you know, we have got such an amazing reservoir there. And I think that, you know, as a director, you often tend to think when you're starting to think about a play or a film or something, you feel like some level in your head, you think, well, you've got to tell them exactly what to do, otherwise they won't know. But of course, that's not the case. Actors come with an extraordinary set of reactions to the material, a set of skills that you kind of go, whoa, I never realized that thing could be as good as this, you know. I mean, it's a perfect example of that is a guy called Paul Ritter, who's a name you probably wouldn't know. He plays Bentley Purchase, the improbably named Bentley Purchase, who's the coroner who provides him with the body. He's a brilliant actor who disappears into every role he plays. Sadly, he died after we'd shot the film, so we actually are the last film he ever made. But you know, I remember when
he's excellent. He's been in many, many things that, I mean, people will recognize him immediately.
Well, they would recognize him.
I didn't know he had passed away.
He was a significant role in Chernobyl, for example.
Yes.
The guy who ran the plant. You know, it just morphs into whatever the plot requires. But it was quite, he's got a lot of information to carry in our story. And I was just sitting there in absolute delight on the first day of shooting. It literally was the first thing we shot, actually, with him in the whole film. And just listening to the way they spin the words, so they just take off into a realm of their own. That's because I admire actors hugely. You know, that's a skill that people don't really understand, and you're working in the midst of it, exactly what they can do. Matthew and Colin, in different ways, are different examples of that. Well, all of them are. Yeah. You know, Kelly, Penelope Wilton is an absolute genius, really, who can do anything. it's the third time I've worked with her, so I know whereof I speak. But I grew up watching her on stage anyway. So, no, I mean, that and Simon Russell Beale, I mean, you know, he's a major, major, major figure and just nails every single phrase that he says in such an amazingly resonant way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the part of the truth is that because your resume, also the quality of the story and the script that you're bringing, and that the nature of the content here, there's going to be a lot of people who want to be involved in it. But, you know, sometimes you write with people in mind, sometimes you don't. Yeah. In this situation, you've got historical figures, and you have, as you know, there's going to be a lot of people interested. As you were helping craft the script, did you have ideas? Because this is going to be so actor forward. Did you have ideas or talk about who?
I certainly did. Yes. I mean, certainly Colin. I mean, you know, to be completely blunt, Colin and Matthew were both pretty installed in my head. We couldn't get Matthew because he was obviously committed to Succession, whose third season, when they thought they were going to be shooting it, was a total clash with our film.
COVID stuff at the same time, right?
That was pre-COVID. In fact, they just got behind on their writing schedule, and suddenly, they pushed back by 2 months, and suddenly he was available. So he got a phone call very quickly, because I think, apart from his uncanny kind of affinity with the role as an actor, he's also physically kind of perfect for it. I mean, he looks very, very like Charles Chumley in terms of his height and the moustache and the sort of gangliness. But he's a proper sort of transforming actor, Matthew. Colin is somebody, obviously, I've known for a long time. He's a good friend of mine, and this seemed like such a perfect role for him. Initially, we were slightly hidebound by the idea that he was a little bit older than the character actually was. But the character, when you see pictures of the real Ewan Montague, you would have put him as older than Colin, just in terms of the way people behaved. Yes. And look, he was a pipe smoker, bald, tall, rangy. You know, he could have been anywhere between, you know, 55 and 70, really, that character. But so, you know, one throws those things aside. You'll get hung up, actually, on exactly what ages people are. So Colin seemed perfect to me. Kelly, likewise. Penelope, I'd always had her in my mind for Hester. Simon Russell Beale, likewise. Paul Ritter didn't come to me initially just because he's so hard to place as an actor. You just think he's a fabulous actor. And when that idea came up from Gina Jay, the casting director, I kind of went, whoa, that's a fantastic idea. Also, I need actually to hoist a flag for the casting director. Gina Jay cast this, and it's a very big cast. And she made me aware of people that I simply wouldn't have been aware of or couldn't have been aware of. So, for example, amazing actress called Gabrielle Creevy, who plays Glendower Michael's sister in the film, is a Welsh-based, she's Welsh, and she's based in Wales as an actor, although I think she'll probably be spreading her wings beyond Wales now. She's just fantastic.
I'm curious also, you know, it's interesting to note, because given where you started with radio and then with television and, like you said, VHS, but then doing a project like this, which for a lot of filmmakers who came at a slightly later time than you, or at an earlier time, doing things that are, you know, a digital medium that's going up on a Netflix kind of platform and streaming would seem like, oh, this is an adjustment. For you, this is like, I assume somewhat like, oh yeah, this is a format I'm familiar with. This is a workflow I know. You know, like, so does it feel kind of like, does it feel like, yes, I know how this works and it's no different? Or because for some people, it's like there's a bemoaning of the changes of the digital mediums and of that. I mean, I glossed over it, but you've seen massive changes in the way this industry works.
It's true. It's true. I mean, this one actually is strangely, like, literally, sort of balanced on the fulcrum of those two things, because it's a theatrical release everywhere else in the world except for the US.
I'm glad you.
It's already in theatrical release in Europe now. We opened there about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. And
I wish I could fly in. I want to go to Europe and see it in the theater then.
Well, you can see it in the next week, actually, because it's a theatrical release in most of the major cities in the next week, because Netflix have their own theatrical release pattern, mainly in New York and LA, which is where I'm speaking from at the moment, New York. It's running in all the Landmark theaters as well for the next week, so it can be seen in the cinema. But it's strange. I'm literally on the cusp of, you know, getting my head around the whole idea that actually this film will be, you know, on demand from now on a digital platform, which of course has been a part of all of our lives for the last 5 years, and particularly the last 3 years, but more than that, really. It's never bothered me hugely. You know, you can't help but feel, if you are a film director, that there's nowhere you would rather the film be seen than in a darkened theater with a very large screen with a lot of other people watching with you. And that's because of the magic that happens when you're experiencing something at the same time as a lot of the other people. There's a yes. sort of chemistry that happens in terms of the way you relate to the material you're watching. And that doesn't happen in a digital landscape. But, you know, this is not the way we consume, or the majority of us consume, a story now.
I guess what's interesting to note is that when you, I also misspoke a little bit, because when you did things like a Star Wars radio play or a BBC series about Sherlock Holmes or those earlier projects, they were kind of, they aired and maybe not again, right? People experienced it and that was right?
That's absolutely true. I mean, Star Wars did, of course, find its way into permanent distribution fairly quickly, but no, that's true. Once they were out, they were gone until, you know, the relevant broadcaster decided to repeat them.
But this is permanent. This is just sitting there every day, every hour, waiting.
Forever, just as this podcast will be for somebody who wants to look for it sometime hence. I'm just looking at a note here from Esther.
Oh, yes. Yes, we have to wrap up. So I guess, you know, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. I know you've got a lot of these to do, and it's been a great conversation. I'm excited for people to see this one.
Thank you very much, George. It's great to speak to you.
Likewise. Have a good day. Okay. Thanks so much to John for coming on the podcast. Thanks, everyone, for listening. It's a treat to get somebody of John's stature on and to have him talk about his reflections on the industry and how it's changed, but also just how he approaches making movies. Be sure to check out a post we have on No Film School called How to Use Dramatic Irony in Film and TV with Examples. We'll throw a link in there in the description, in the show notes, because that's kind of what we're talking about here, is dramatic irony and creating tension in your writing and in your story. And I think that's what makes Operation Mincemeat so fascinating as a source for stories, not just based on the actual event, but just a blooming of ideas that come out of that kind of situation. So enjoy the film, enjoy the post, enjoy the podcast. Be sure to like, rate, and subscribe. Hey, we've had a lot of big directors on lately. We've been blessed. We had the Daniels from Everything Everywhere All at Once in a very long episode, but an amazing episode in terms of how much we cover. And we also had Robert Eggers on a shorter episode where we talked about The Northmen, which is another incredible film from this month. So be sure to go back through the catalog and see all the things that we've done lately. Thanks so much for listening.